Could you first tell me, Mr. Ashton, where and when you were born?
Yes, indeed. I'd be delighted to do that. I was born on the 15th of February, 1929. I was born in Surrey, and I was christened at Tandridge. The village I was born in was Woldingham, Surrey.
And who were your parents?
My parents were... My father was Angus Alexander Graham Ashton, and he was born in December 1890. That was 24 years before the First World War. And my mother was Audrey Mary Conyers Ashton, and she was born on the 16th of October 1892. So my parents were born in 1890 and 1892.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I had three brothers. My eldest brother died at the age of 6 months, and my second eldest brother, who has been my eldest brother all my life, is 8 years older and was born in 1922.
And what did your father do for a living?
My father did various occupations. He was a highly intelligent and talented gentleman. He came down from Cambridge University with an economics degree. He was the generation which was effectively wiped out by the First World War, the 1914-18 war. At the age of 22, he went out to Kenya, and he was in Kenya when the war broke out, which was effectively saved his life. He would have returned immediately, but he was advised that it couldn't possibly last longer than 6 months, and therefore he didn't return to this country until April 1918. He was a district commissioner in Kenya. He then volunteered, but by then the war was virtually over. He did various jobs in the city. All the members of his house, Peter House 8, were killed or murdered by November 1914, and therefore a great number of his generation were missing. And it was relatively easy to get jobs, and he got very good ones, and he became, in fact, a stockbroker, which was extremely successful. Only, it wasn't a big stockbreaking firm, and up to 1929, it was boom conditions. And by 1931, he found that his income was about a 50th of what it had been, and he then joined, the Royal Exchange Assurance Company as financial advisor, or financial secretary, or financial manager, whatever you care to call it, to my Lord Bicester and the court of directors of the Royal Exchange, where he worked from the age of 40 years to 60 years. After his retirement, he became more successful than he ever was in that he got a number of extremely interesting jobs that I won't bore you with, but his most successful stage of his career was from the age of 60 to 80.
Did you ever know your grandparents?
Just, but only one. On my mother's side, they were both dead at my birth in 1929. On my father's side, my grandmother died, and I just met my grandfather, my father's father.
Did they have any city connections?
No. My grandfather on my mother's side was a Yorkshire or a Bradford wool merchant, which was very much a trader organization, and I reckon what little ability I've got in this market would have developed from my grandfather. He went to work at the age of 12 as a mill hand and was a mill manager by the age of 19 and an immensely successful entrepreneur and made a substantial sums of money which were all lost in the end by his sons. But that's clogs to clogs and another story. On my father's side, my grandfather on my father's side was a clergyman and he was storing up treasures in heaven and not on earth.
Your father was leaving the stock exchange or had just left the stock exchange when you were born, but did you ever learn anything about the stock exchange as a boy?
Absolutely. It was the one area that I wouldn't have wished my children or myself to enter. I looked upon it as a very second-rate organization, something which I didn't approve of considerably. I mean, I liked the idea of owning stocks and shares, but I looked upon stock brokers, and I underline brokers, as very third-class people, and I considered the real world of manufacturing and industry, and banking was much more my idea of, and therefore I felt I would like to learn this aspect of it. Although I must stress, from a very early age, I had been a trader, and I'll go into that later, but I was very interested in buying and selling.
What was the attitude to money in the family?
rather, attitude to money was rather larger than I think of the similar background, in that my father, being the son of a clergyman, virtually had no money at all. My mother, being the daughter of a very successful wool merchant, should have had a lot of money, but it was all lost and the trust was mismanaged. And therefore my parents, although they were very intelligent and lively and socially very acceptable, were mixing with Amelia, who were very much better off than themselves. And therefore I was slightly aware that although I was extremely fortunate, and although my father had a very substantial income, or a not very, but a substantial income, we were not, well endued to capital goods. We didn't have a big estate, we didn't have houses in London and houses in the country. We did have two houses, but we weren't, a member of the very favored few who were extremely well off before the war, although we mixed with in that grouping.
Would you say any of your parents had a particular influence on you?
Yes, my mother had a very, both my parents, I consider, had a very favorable influence. I respected my father and his obvious ability and his intelligence. He was highly intelligent, and he was very careful with money, never having had any money, and therefore we were fairly, not puritanical, but we were fairly careful. I mean, for instance, if you came to our house, you would only find sort of one bottle of sherry and one bottle of gin, not by current standards the usual mass of different alcoholic beverages which would get offered. On my mother's side, she, I had a nurse and I had a Norlan nanny, but she always looked after me and took an infinite trouble with me, and therefore I regard my parents with the highest affection.
Where did they send you to school?
I was sent to a number of schools, not entirely their fault. I started off at Yardley Court Preparatory School at Tunbridge, but I was a sickly child and I didn't prosper particularly well. And after a year, I was taken away and sent to the New Beacon at Sevenoaks, which was an excellent private school, preparatory school. I really enjoyed it. It was run by delightful people and I liked the other people in it. I very shortly became a boarder again. And then by 1940, we were being heavily bombed. We lived in a house in Kent, my father had bought a farm in Suffolk, which he was a weekend farmer, and at the outbreak of war, we moved into a flat in London, and the farm in Suffolk became our home near Woodbridge, and we were asked by the Agricultural Committee to take over the management of it, and my mother ran the farm during the war, and I was taken away from the New Beacon and went to Woodbridge Grammar School for 2 years, which was a very interesting exercise, because I was a day boy, and Woodbridge Grammar School had ostensibly a high educational standard. In actual fact, all the masters had gone to the war, and the education was not very good, and I only just managed to get into my public school, which was very fortunately I was sent to Eton, and I was extraordinarily lucky, in my opinion, to be sent to that. I wasn't intended, the intention was not to send me to Eton, I was going to Marlborough, but due to the war, so many prospective boys for Eton had been sent to America that they had various vacancies, and my father saw a wonderful opportunity to send his youngest son to the school, and I benefited enormously from it.
How long were you at Eton?
5 years.
Thinking ahead to your future career as a jobber, would you say any of the masters had a particular influence on you, or perhaps an influence on your life generally?
Yes, the masters had tremendous influence on one's life because they were outstanding men in general. My housemaster, my house tutor was a very high quality, and so were my classical tutors. I was not a scholar, and I was not an academic by any stretch of imagination, and I was not a good games player. Therefore, by any rhyme or reason, I was not an outstanding member. I succeeded enjoying my time at all my schools enormously, against the odds, although I adored the holidays. The school time was not an agony to me. And although I had a very ordinary, pedestrian career, I happened to get a great deal out of school. Did they influence me? No, but it was during the war. The war was a great leveler. I didn't realize the enormous social and financial differences there were between myself and various other members in my tutors. We were all rationed. I didn't realize the chap I was sharing with rooms and eating tea owned half of Scotland, and I was of a very different ilk. We were all very much on the same level. It was an extraordinarily interesting situation to find oneself in. And I would only say that it didn't enhance. The Stock Exchange was not a popular place, or the city in general was not considered a very attractive area to go into. I don't say that was necessarily Eton or any other. I'm just saying it was a social situation of the country. We were fighting for our lives. We were after production, engineering, politics, the fact of the Foreign Office, everything, the direction of the country, and the Stock Exchange was very low down the list of priorities.
What were your plans as you came towards the end of your education?
Plan was that I should not go to universities. I'd been a certain amount of money had been spent on my education up to that date, and I should immediately try and achieve a qualification. And the qualification my father chose for me was that I should become a chartered accountant, because he thought it was a very good general standing. He did appreciate that I wasn't good at exams, and I said that I doubted whether I could actually become an accountant, which I didn't achieve. But it was an extremely interesting 5 years, and it taught me one thing, and that was that I went over the country doing accounts and accountancy, and I learned that in the City of London, we had a very attractive way of life in comparison to Hardison, Preston, Birmingham, Glasgow, or anywhere else, which was much more parochial, and their standard of living was certainly not up to the London standard of living, and also one saw very many more of one's friends and acquaintances in London than you did at Southport or Devizes or wherever the local organization happened to be.
Where were you living while you were doing your accounting?
I was living with my parents in our flat in London.
And so you didn't continue with the accounting?
At the end of the 5 years, I then was liable for national service, and I spent 2 years in an armored cavalry regiment called the Queen's Bays, the 2nd Dragoon Guards. And that took place from 1953 to 1955. And I said to my father, I'm getting on, I'm now 25 years old, and I've learned a lot about business and industry, and I want to make some money. And he said, well, that's very admirable, but how do you intend to do it? And I said, well, I've always been interested in dealing, buying and selling. And I think, despite all I've said in the past about the Stock Exchange, I think we ought to think of this being a stockbroker. And he said, well, you're partially right, but in actual fact, you ought to become a stock jobber. And I said, what's the difference? And he said, well, you are the principal, you are the market maker, you are the person who carries the stock and makes the prices. And I said, right.
And that was the primary reason he directed you towards jobbing rather than broking?
Yes. Also, he didn't want me to become a broker, although he had a large number. All his city friends were brokers. He didn't want me to become a broker because he said you had to spend a great deal of your spare time being extremely pleasant to clients. And as a jobber, you had a relatively limited number of clients being the brokers, and you dealt with them during the day, and your great friends you obviously saw at the weekends, but it was quite the same salesman-client relationship that the broking fraternity suffered from. He had been a broker himself.
So how did you go about becoming a jobber?
I went about by the fact that various friends of mine at school came into this organization and ended up, and this is something which one didn't at the time. My three immediate contemporaries ended up in the Stock Exchange, and they achieved tremendous distinction. And one of them was Nigel Althouse, who was a government broker. His father was a man called Frederick Althouse, who was a very great friend of my father's. And I went to see him, and he said, I will find you a position in the jobbing fraternity. I know they are looking out for keen young men who want to join them.
And so you managed to get a contact with Francis and Praed.
So I was introduced by Mr. Althouse to Francis and Praed, who I was very pleased to join, until I joined them and found that I was the only young man of my age in the organization. Otherwise, they were all 20 years older than myself, which says quite a lot for the
organization. How would you describe the firm at the time that you joined it?
Geriatric.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
I can say that I was very pleased, in a way, to find that I was the only pebble on the beach, i.e. age 25, but I was equally unnerved by the fact that there was nobody of my own age group, and there seemed to be no organization of recruitment, but I appreciated it. It was a situation where there had been a number of partners and they were all coming up to retirement in the next 10 or 15 years, and they had been too busy with the war and their own affairs after the war to recruit people, but it obviously there was a great gap, in my opinion.
What kind of a firm was it? Was it a family firm?
It was a small family firm, medium-sized family firm.
And which markets did they deal in?
Primarily, solely in the government, British government bond gilt hedge market.
Were they an old firm?
Yes, they've been in existence about 50 years.
Could you describe any of the partners at the time?
Yes, I could describe them all well, but I wouldn't want to waste your time. They were basically, they were all interrelated, was I think the most important point. They were either married to each other as brothers or sisters, they were married to the sisters of our partners. They were all very much the same age, and there was also a very healthy situation where two of them were the sons of a very successful member of the partnership. So it was a small family partnership.
What was your first job?
My first job was in the office, going through the office at a relatively high speed prior to going down as a blue button on the floor of the market.
What were the offices like at this time?
They were the third floor of Kent House, which we can see out of this window. And they were about, I think, 1,600 square feet. They were basically four large rooms. There was my partner's dealing room, where also the authorized clerks and the authorized dealers were allowed to sit. The partners had an inner sanctum. There was the ledger room, there was the general office, and there was the cash and the telephone. But that was basically all it was.
So you spent a short time in the office before moving
I spent
the house
6
itself.
Months in the office, and then I went down to the house as a blue button.
And what did that involve?
That involved running for my masters and carrying out their every whim and request on the floor and booking bargains and balancing the books and making sure that each stock added up and was correct to the positions as held by the office after the day's deals had been recorded, running messages to brokers to ensure that they got our offers or bids as quickly, if not quicker, than the opposition, so one wanted to be fairly fleet of foot, and generally carrying out one's masters, perhaps going to the local bookmaker and putting on the side bet for the 3:30, or perhaps booking a table for his lunch, or perhaps going and doing even shopping for him, i.e. a general office boy job on the floor of the stock exchange.
Can you remember any of your first impressions of going into the house? Or
yes,
your first impressions of the market?
Vividly. I didn't think that I could possibly stand it because the noise and the people, as the guards officer Dunkirk so wittily said, appalled me. But within a week, I discovered the people were delightful and the noise I didn't even notice. But
how did the gilt market contrast with other parts of the old house? Was it noisier, or was it simply the general hum of the
It was the general roar of the business, which was the factor that I noticed on entering. It was my first Monday morning, and the fact that I stood miss the day I found it was rather like being at a very a noisy race meeting. And in fact, when I was first asked what it was like, I said it was like being at a cocktail party without any drinks. But that was not necessarily a very adept or accurate description. But the point was that there were a lot of people moving around, talking to one another, and there was a tremendous hubbub, general hubbub of noise. And that was to say it was the number of people and the noise, which was the factors that I noticed.
And how long were you at Blue Button?
A very short period of, I think, about 6 months again. And then I became an authorized dealer and a member within about a year.
And what did those stages involve?
Those stages involved with being allowed to deal. Of course, I was I held a book in my hand and booked bargains for the market makers as a blue button. That was part of my job, as they said, pick up the book and book this bargain, I had to remember immediately what they'd been saying and what the price was. So one had to be alert and on one's toes. If you were sleepy or had had a bad night, your days, even in those in that time, in the 50s, were obviously very limited. People were not of any great interest to the organization if they weren't very much alert and very much on their toes. Therefore, the point was that you had to be wide awake, I would say, was the answer. And as an authorized dealer, you then, of course, were probably given your own part of the book, just a number of stocks, which you made prices in and booked bargains. But again, there'd be probably a limit on it, i.e., that a broker would come up and say, "Angus, what is the price of Worley?" And by then he'd be calling me by my Christian name, and I would say, "They are 70 to a quarter to a half, that's 70 and 8/32 or 16/32. And he'd say, "I'm in quarter million." I would have then turned immediately to my senior partner and said, "Sir, I've got Bloggs, who wants to deal in quarter million Worley," and he would have taken over from him. But if he said, "I want to buy 10,000 or 50,000, I'd have booked the bargain. I was a small dealer on a major book.
Mm. Where did you actually learn your dealing skills?
Well, I do feel very strongly that dealing skills are overrated. I have always, since a very early age, been a dealer like everybody else. I've been aware of the value of money, and I've been aware that if I was interested in a situation where it was buying or selling a motorcycle or a bicycle or on the farm, having a farm background during the war, I kept rabbits. I was very interested in the price of rabbits, and sometimes it was a good time to sell rabbits to the market, and if the ration had been put down on meat, well, that was a good time to send off some more buck rabbits to see what they'd fetch. In fact, there was one ghastly time when my rabbits fetched more than my mother's pigs were fetching, so, because they just not only cut the meat ration, but they'd also forbidden import of feeding stocks for pigs, and therefore they thought they would take up less shipping to bring in the finished product rather than the food to feed them. So I've always been aware of that in certain situations there's a market price, and I think most people are that. I think you've got to be relatively average intelligence, and I think you've got to be numerate, which I was very fortunate. I've always been able to add and subtract at a relatively advantageous speed.
What was standing on the pitch like as a young dealer? You said that you'd be referring back to a more senior partner. Were you standing very close to each other?
Uncomfortably close, I would describe it as. Was generally pushed forward so as to meet the onslaught or the lack of business frontally. Very much depended who you were working for. If you worked with a man who you got on well with and you had a rapport with, well, it was a lovely life. If you worked for what you might describe as an ace bastard, it wasn't a very pleasant life, no.
Again, do you have any early memories as a young dealer of particular experiences, either disasters or triumphs? Or?
Oh, yes. I had a very generous and a very clever, intellectually clever boss. He wasn't a particularly good jobber, but he was finally my senior partner. He was a man called Humphrey Mackworth Praed, who I regard with the highest affection and respect. He should have been a don at Oxford. He shouldn't have actually been a jobber at all. But I was standing in front of him, and a little elderly gentleman came up and said, we were on the corporation market, and said, "What are Herefordshire 5 1/2s? And I said, "They are 83 3/4, sir." And he said, "I'll sell you £475, all or nothing." And the word "all or nothing," I'd only been on the floor a few weeks, meant absolutely, it was no importance to me at all. And I said £475 and bought £475. My bosses were standing beside me at the time, and they said nothing either. Next morning, on the checking, my £475 was shown as a purchase by Francis and Praed, but the vending broker showed it as a sale of £475,000. And my senior partner said, "Did you realize you bought £475,000? I said, "No, I didn't. I bought £475. And he said, "But he said, all or nothing. I heard him say it." And I said, "Well, I'm very sorry, Humphrey, but that means nothing to me, sir. What does it mean to you?" And he said, well, I'm not quite sure, Angus, but I think it means hundreds of thousands of pounds. So I said, well, why the hell didn't the man say so? And this had been something which before the 1939 war was recognized adage that all or nothing meant hundreds of thousands of pounds. Humphrey had never actually had it to deal with, and I certainly, my third week on the floor, had never had it. We did, in actual fact, buy the stock, and we took a substantial profit on it, but that was beside the point.
Was that a particularly large transaction?
For that particular stock, in that particular market, it would have certainly involved a different price, the price I'd given him. The fact was that the market was moving upwards, and the price we would have knocked in. If he'd opened, we'd have taken probably another eight ticks, another quarter of a point off, 8 centiseconds, and we'd have dealt the figure. But as it was, we sold him, I think, for a very handsome. I think we sold him 3/4 point profit. It was very handsome because the market was moving upwards fast.
Now you mentioned that you got pushed through to becoming, or you became a member fairly soon after becoming a dealer. What's the background to that?
The background was my age, which was 25, and therefore I was considered responsible. I'd been commissioned in the army. I'd done 5 years chartered accountancy. I was considered, after they'd looked at me for 6 months in the office and given me a good rating, and I obviously was considered alert, keen, on the floor. And after 6 months, I became an auto dealer, and I was a member within a year. Yes, it was a time when I didn't have to pass any exams. All I had to do was to reduce a sum of money of £1,000 to buy my membership. And that was all that was required at that stage. I hadn't got £1,000, incidentally, but my father lent me.
Had any other younger people come into the firm?
No.
No. And what were the partners thinking in terms of the future of the firm at this time?
They weren't. They were thinking on a day-to-day, short-term basis, and this was the fundamental problem that France and Trade suffered from.
Could you perhaps elaborate on that a little bit more?
Well, that I joined them in 1955, and I did, in actual fact, handed my notice in 1971, but the writing was clearly on the wall, and by August 1972, the partnership was wound up, so in a matter of 17 years, it declined into a situation where it was no longer a viable organization.
Yes. Did the partners at the time of your joining, or the early part of your career, ever feel the need to expand the firm?
Yes, but they were capable of making substantial sums of money, which they did, and it was just that they, in all fairness to them, they did have the wrong attitude. They were taking a short-term view, and they were not taking a long-term view like our competitors in Wet Durlacher and Ackroyd and Swillers, which were using the wealth they were generating in the government bond market to expand into the equity market. And although my partners had substantial equity holdings and had a great deal of interest in the equity side, they never undertook the expansion into the equity market they should have done. So this is jobbing backwards, but with the benefit of hindsight, that's what should have been done. And shortly after me, they did recruit some further. The new people were brought in. I was the first person to be brought in of the younger generation.
What was the next stage in your career after becoming a member?
I became a partner in 1959, so after 4 years. In 3 years after having been an authorized dealer, I became a partner in 1959.
And what did partnership involve for you?
Well, it involved obviously responsibility, because there was no salary. You didn't get paid anything. You were entirely on your own. I had no money, so again I went to my father and borrowed money off him, because I had to put £10,000 into the partnership, which I didn't possess. And I was allowed to draw out £2,000 a year of this money, which was capital in actual fact, and borrowed money. And I had no salary at all, and I waited until the end of the first year to see whether we'd made any money, to see whether my efforts and work had been worthwhile.
Where were you living at this point? Were you?
I was, by then my father had retired, and we no longer had a flat in London, and I was sharing a flat with three other young men.
What was a typical day for you, like at this stage in your career, the early years of being a partner in the firm?
Well, one had once, I was immensely enthusiastic and very keen to succeed in my business. I was ambitious to get on and to acquire a certain amount of money so as I could afford a house and a wife and a family. And so I was motivated, strongly motivated by the lack of capital, my own financial capital. I was therefore meeting and mixing socially with a lot of amusing and exciting people. So I had a very relaxed and attractive social life in London, which I found most entertaining. And I equally had a not very stressful and a not, I didn't work particularly long hours, as you'll see when you ask me that question.
Well, can we go through the different stages of your typical day, if you can remember?
Well, I've just been writing them down, since you say it. I'm Blue Barton, authorized dealer, member of the Stock Exchange Partner. That's what I was career. Typical day, 9 o'clock arrived in the office. I was probably the first in the office at 9 o'clock.
Was it a long journey to work?
No, it was from South Audley Street, so I walked across Grosvenor Square to Bond Street and came down on the central line, so it was literally 12 minutes on or 10 minutes on the underground and 10 minutes walking, which was quite a good idea. It was about a 25-minute journey.
Did you read the paper on your way?
Almost definitely. This is not only did I listen to the wireless cooking my breakfast, because it was vital, although you didn't have money programs and you didn't have anything like Dawn Traders on LBC that you do now have. It was vital to know before you were